Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, so happy that you are with us today. We'll begin today's Main Street with a very personal and courageous story. North Dakota resident Billy Kitzman, at just age 38, has been diagnosed with colorectal cancer. Her story is one of courage and hope, but coming in just a bit, the story behind the Prairie Fish Fry. Dr. Tom Easern traces how a Midwestern tradition made its way to North Dakota, then how FFA programs in urban schools are growing the next generation of agriculture leaders. We'll also hear how a Blackfeet Nation scientist is using robot beavers to restore wetlands, and how Los Angeles is turning wastewater into a new source of drinking water. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and colorectal cancer has been long considered a disease that affects older adults, but doctors across the country and here in North Dakota are seeing more cases in people, both men and women, under 50. Fargo resident Billy Kitzman never imagined she would be one of them. Last fall, she was dealing with fatigue and abdominal pain that she initially dismissed as minor issues, but when her symptoms suddenly worsened, a visit to the doctor revealed something far more serious, a large tumor and dangerously low blood levels caused by prolonged internal bleeding. Billy underwent emergency treatment, surgery to remove part of her colon, and now continues chemotherapy while sharing her story to help others recognize warning signs earlier. She joins us today on Main Street to talk about her diagnosis, her treatment, and why she hopes her experience will encourage people, especially younger adults, not to ignore the symptoms that feel unusual. Billy, it's great to visit with you. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
How are you doing?
Good. This is an off week of chemo for me, and so I've bounced back and I'm feeling kind of rock star-y with got my blood and treatment. You know, I'm just, feeling really good. So
take us back, Billy, to when this all began. What were the first symptoms you noticed? And then what were you thinking at the time?
Oh, man. Okay. So it had been months. I was super lethargic, just didn't really have a lot of energy. And I just thought maybe I'm not sleeping, maybe I'm not eating right. I was getting increasingly more tired and fatigued. And I adopted a dog in April, so I've been having to like go up and down the stairs and walk her outside and back home again. And so I was just, I remember that the day that I went to the walk-in, I had to let go of her leash so she could just run up the stairs on her way back in because I couldn't keep up with her. And I was like, I am not 100% at all today. And so I went to work and was just like hit with a wave of nausea, and I was like, I'm just gonna bop into the walk-in really quick because it's like something isn't right. Abdominal pain I'd been having, I was up all night the night before because I had some weird pain in like the middle of my chest that I hadn't had, and I was like, that's a new pain. So we'll just go get that checked out. And I left my computer on because I thought I was coming back to work, and I ended up getting admitted to the hospital that day.
And when you say April, that was about a year ago.
Oh, it was October. So sorry. Okay. I adopted my dog in April, okay. And then it had been months where I'm just not able to keep up with her. She's a 2-year-old puppy. So she quickly showed me how tired I was.
You look great now, and you seem full of energy. What were the, final symptoms that really made you think, oh no, something's up?
That surprise pain that showed up kind of in my chest was alarming, and then just how fatigued I was, and I had like, I just couldn't catch my breath, and I got a little lightheaded just going up a flight of stairs, mm-hmm. and I had this really weird like high-pitched ringing sound in my ear. I don't know if that was like part of it or not, but that was another weird symptom that had popped up, and I'm like, okay, it's getting real weird. We should probably go to the doctor.
So when you went in, the doctors realized maybe something was wrong. What was that moment like for you?
I think I disassociated a little bit, and I was just kind of just mostly oddly curious and fascinated about what was going on, because I had a really boring medical history leading up to all of this. I'd never spent a night in the hospital.
Felt good. A healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, well, mostly, I think. I was just really lucky. I should probably eat better than I do. But I was just like, okay, I guess we're just along for a ride now, is kind of where my brain was at that time.
So your hemoglobin level had dropped dangerously because you were bleeding internally.
Yeah.
What did the doctors tell you about what was happening in your body?
Well, when they told me, it was in the walk-in, they said my hemoglobin was 4.8 and that I needed to go. He was like, are you okay to drive? Because it was so dangerously low. I was like, yeah, I'm fine. I guess I can just drive there. It's no worries. He said, do you need an ambulance? I'm like, no, I'll just drive. It's cool.
What were you thinking?
I was like, I didn't 100% know what that meant. But once they were explaining that, like the volume level that they, because I had been admitted, I was on my first blood transfusion, and I think it was Rachel had explained that, like that, the blood satchel hanging up there, she's like, you basically had like four of those in your whole body, that you had like no blood. And I was just like, how am I here? So it was a little shocking.
So you had a colonoscopy that confirmed cancer. Yeah. How did you process that? You were only 38 at the time.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I've just had so many like crazy things happen that I think I dissociated again during it. And I was just kind of like, okay, so I might have cancer. We'll just deal with that, because fun little surprises pop up in life, you know. And so I was like, okay, well, let's do it. Like, worst case scenario, like, I find out what happens after all this, you know. And then best case scenario, they'll fix me and I'll be good and we just keep on trucking, I guess.
Your story was shared with me via the Essentia Health website. You named your tumor.
I did.
Tell me about that.
I named it Carla. It turns out it is the same. It is. I had a high school geometry teacher named Carla, but I also am just a sucker for alliteration, so I'm like Carla the colon cancer. It just also kind of fit. I have a tendency to name things. My truck is named Dimples, for example. He's suffered some hail damage, so everything has a name, I guess, including my cancer.
So humor seems to be maybe a part of how you're coping.
Absolutely.
Is that important to have a humorous outlook on things for you?
Yes, for sure, 100%. I have to laugh or I'll cry, but I guess I also like laughter through tears is my favorite emotion. Mm-hmm. It's a quote from Steel Magnolias. Mm-hmm. Dolly Parton, I think, said it. But anyway, yeah, that's just kind of been a lifelong thing for me.
So you then had surgery to remove the tumor and part of your colon, and then started chemotherapy, which you're still undergoing now. What's that treatment process been like, both physically for you and emotionally for you?
Okay. So I guess treatment-wise, well, even surgery, it was scary because it was unknown, but all of the like nurses and doctors that I've met along the way have been so caring and kind and just willing to answer any questions I had. So I never really felt scared. I've just felt really taken care of the whole time. And I've had a really great support system too. So that's also helped. Really supportive partner that's like brought me to all my appointments. We like jammed out to our favorite song together before I went into surgery. So chemotherapy started about a month after my surgery. And I had, you know, you're not supposed to like Google medical things, but I was just what's it kind of like? Because I didn't know what to expect, because you just see in movies people just throw up a lot and lose their hair, chemotherapy. So I'm just like, is that what's going to happen to me? And so I guess with colon cancer, the FOLFOX is a common chemotherapy that you receive. And so I was looking into that specifically, and it did affect me that after the first treatment I suffer neuropathy and cold sensitivity in my hands and in like my throat. And then there is a thing called first bite, where I guess it's like your saliva glands, when you're about to like take your first bite of something, your jaw kind of locks up and you experience some like jaw pain. That goes away like within like a minute. Neuropathy's kind of hung around the whole time. Even on the good weeks, like outside, my hands get really tingly and fatigue on molecular level, but still not as bad as it was when I had no blood in my body. So grateful for that. That's kind of the only symptoms I've really experienced so far. It's kind of slowed me down a little bit, but I'm super grateful. I haven't felt like worse. It could be so much worse, and so very grateful for that.
Enjoying my conversation with Billy Kitzman. She's 38 years old. She's a Fargo resident, and she thought fatigue and abdominal pain were nothing to worry about. Instead, doctors have discovered advanced colorectal cancer, and she's joining us to share her story and the warning signs younger adults, all of us, shouldn't ignore. In your journey, Billy, the treatment process has unveiled that you have two small lesions on your liver. What's your medical team told you about that and the next steps in that treatment?
It was a bit of a gut punch when I found out that I had liver spots. Recalibrate. Okay, cool. We'll deal with that. They've explained that Dr. Cabrosi said, well, it didn't change my treatment, really. We're going to chemotherapy, FOLFOX.
FOLFOX. Yeah. What does that mean?
It's an acronym for the three different drugs that make it up. Okay. I forget. They'll be able to explain that so much better than I can. I just remember the oxaliplatin is like the one that really gets me with the cold sensitivity and stuff, I think is that one. But it's lovingly dubbed FOLFOX is the term for it. So once we found my liver spots, he said we're gonna do potentially a radio frequency ablation, I think is RFA treatment is what they said. And then it's basically it's a tool that enables you to just like zap those two spots specifically. So the rest of my liver will be like fine doing livery things, and then those two spots get zapped out of there. So
I wanna take you back and examine a little bit more the support system that you said that you have in place first when you first recognized the issues and even today. What's helped you most through the experience that you would like to share with our listeners as they may be helping someone in their family who also is experiencing cancer?
Oh, man. There's a lot of really good humans in my life. We've had people bring, meal train was established immediately, so we were never hungry. DoorDash gift cards have been huge. That made it so easy. I live downtown, so we just did like DoorDash pickup for things super easy. And my workplace has so many incredible humans there. They've been really awesome and just like supportive, just like cheering me up, but also really understanding of time off I've needed to take. The people directly in my life, the meal trains, walking Millie. Millie is my little doggo. They were set up, taking her on her adventure walks and stuff, so that when she'd come home, she'd be more of like a chill bean and just kind of back in her nurse role, just hanging out with me and cuddles. That's helped a lot. And then my partner, John, he's the one that kind of helped orchestrate all of that and has been like the barrier between me and all the crazy and just kind of looking out for me and not extra stress on top of like cancer. He's just letting me heal. And that's awesome too. But yeah, everyone's just been incredible. I didn't know. But yeah.
I think sometimes people aren't sure what to say to one of their friends or one of their loved ones who've had a serious diagnosis, even surgery, even undergoing chemotherapy. What advice would you have to those folks?
You don't even have to say anything. Just to be like, wow, this sucks, and I'm here for you. And just, if they're a hugger, hugs are good. Just being like, I'm here to support you, I know this. Just sit in the suck, I guess. Just sit in the suck with them and just be like, hey, it's cool.
Really, you've been willing to share your experience publicly. Why has that been important for you?
I guess if there's just, as I told everyone, I'm a little weird, but if there's anything I can say or do just to get people in for their screening so they don't have to go on this roller coaster ride, sign me up. I'm here for you, and I support you, and I know people often will say, like, if there's anything you need, let me know. But that's so hard because I'm super Midwestern. I'm never going to be like, hi, can you bring me an egg bake? And so just being like, hey, I love you. I'm here for you. That's everything.
And then you've made a decision to be public with this.
Yes.
Yes. Tell me more about why that's important for you.
Just if there's anything I could say or do to get someone to listen to their body if something weird is going on, just to please go get screened. This journey's been crazy and terrible because cancer sucks, but the glimmers in it have have been incredible, and I've met some really kind, amazing humans on the way, but it'd be nice to have met those people under different circumstances. Sure. So don't get colon cancer to meet cool people. Just go meet the cool people and get your screening first, I guess.
Was colon cancer ever on your radar of things?
Not at all. Not even a little bit. No, that was a surprise.
What have doctors told you about the prevalence among younger people who are now getting colon cancer?
I saw that it's like the biggest like cancer killer in rising in young people.
How do you keep hope? What's your prognosis?
Whew, not gonna get emotional. Okay, we don't cry on the radio, Billy. What gives me hope is just, no matter how, we're good. No matter how bad or challenging things are, that there's like a glimmer in literally everything. So I guess my hope is the glimmers, like my dog and the people that I've met and just the amazing providers I've had. I lost my mom and dad in the last decade. And so to not like have my parents along for this journey. I'm grateful they're not here because then they don't have to worry, but I guess the hope is that even if things get really bad and I have to, that I pass away and that I'm not on this timeline anymore, I know that that means I get to hang out with them again. So I'm like, really, my hope is that either way, I win. If I live, I win because I get to stay here and hang out. And then where everybody dies, like Dr. Ernst said in his article. But so when that time comes, I just get to have a party on that side then. So either way, I win. So I guess that's my hope.
Oh, Billy, we hope you have many parties here.
Thank you, Craig. I hope so
first.
Too.
Billy Kitzman, she's a Fargo resident currently undergoing treatment for colorectal cancer. Her message is simple but powerful. Listen to your body and don't ignore symptoms that feel unusual. Doctors say colorectal cancer is rising among younger adults. We talked about that, and screening is now recommended beginning at age 45 or even earlier for certain risk factors. That's changed in my lifetime. Upcoming programs, we'll talk with Essential Health doctors who have worked with Billy about what people should know about colorectal cancer screenings, diagnosis, and treatment. Billy, thanks for sharing your story today. Good luck.
Thanks, Craig.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Lent is a season that brings with it a familiar ritual across the Upper Midwest, the Friday night fish fry. But the tradition many communities take for granted is actually a recent development shaped by religion, immigration, prohibition, and even wartime rationing. Plainsfolk essay writer Dr. Tom Ezern takes a look at how the humble fish fry became a community institution across North Dakota and the region.
In a lovely book of 2008, America Eats, author Pat Willard puts fish fries into her subtitle, but hardly mentions them in her book-length discussion of food events in American culture. Examining the custom in our own region, I have figured out why. Willard relies heavily on WPA interview transcripts from the 1930s, and fish fries, it turns out, are a more recently evolved custom than that. I mean fish fries as a come-all public event for a profit or charity as a community institution. The cultural history of fish fries is remembered history, often recounted by journalists, but consensus places the center of fish fry culture to the east of North Dakota, in the Midwest, more specifically Wisconsin. It makes sense in a region filled with immigrants, many Catholic, hugging the Great Lakes. It comes more slowly to the prairies. A folktale credits a pope in the distant past with instituting meat fasts as an astute measure to benefit fishermen. Actually, no. There is no evidence of that. Meatless holidays and meatless Fridays accumulated incrementally on the church calendar. Protestants were not observant until the 1540s, when it was King Edward VI who restored legal meatless days, in fact, to benefit fishermen. When Pope John Paul loosened fasting requirements in the 1960s, there remained the practice of meatless Fridays during Lent. Over here, a couple of other factors were at work. Prohibition moved tavern operators to offer free fried fish to patrons, and then on arrival, served them beer surreptitiously. Then, post-prohibition, came meat rationing during World War II, and supper clubs instituted all-you-can-eat fish fries for protein-starved customers. Post-war, the Lenten custom continued, both for profit, but more and more for charity, with benevolent organizations serving the public. In North Dakota, we're on the edge of all this, but since World War II, fish fries have proliferated as community events. In the 19th century, they were private affairs, often happening when some adept recreational fisherman had a surplus of fish and fed his friends. I find that in 1920, about 1,500 people, despite a disabled Missouri River ferry, attended a fish fry in American Legion Park, Trenton. A large number also attended a catfish fry in Stanton in 1927, despite the problem that high water made fishing hard for the local fellows who had promised to provide the fish, and the catfish had to be purchased. These were not fish fries in the modern sense. They were fish festivals that also comprised ball games and other festivities over two or more days, including a prize fight in Stanton. Soon, though, taverns were beginning to advertise fish fries on Fridays. An early example was the Skaluda Tavern at Grafton in the 1940s, beginning during meat rationing days of the Second World War. By my research, I declare the inauguration of the modern fish fry, a public event generally hosted by a church or other benevolent organization, to be at St. Michael's Church of Grand Forks, during the Lenten season of 1955. Weekly Friday fish fries there charged $1 for adults, 50 cents for children. This Lenten season of 2026, they are firing up the fryers at the Till House for the Lakota School District, at Wells Drinking Well in Park River for the baseball and softball programs, at the Argusville Community Hall for St. William's Church, and at scores of other venues across the state. The Catholic Diocese of Bismarck and Fargo promote the events, and of course, taverns also get in on the action. I resolved to get to several such events myself this year, including my usual at the Farmhouse Fraternity of NDSU.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a historian at North Dakota State University, an author and presenter of Plainsfolk, a weekly reflection on the culture and history of the Northern Plains. Ahead on Main Street, robot beavers, restoring wetlands, a story about how a Blackfeet Nation scientist is doing exactly that. That and a lot more is ahead on Main Street. It's all right after this.
Employment grew 10% nationwide between 2010 and 2024, according to USDA data. That means potential jobs for people who grew up far from traditional agriculture. Chapters of FFA, what was once called Future Farmers of America, are becoming more common in urban schools. Harvest Public Media contributor Katie Gravich reports.
University City High School is in the center of the sprawl in and around the city of St. Louis. About as insulated as it could be from the wide swaths of farmland outside the city. Tucked in the back of the school, between the gymnasium and the swimming facility, is a shipping container dropped on school grounds last summer. Inside is a hydroponic farm, and students in the school's agriculture program are growing their first batches of lettuce, basil, and collards.
You can grow all year round. You don't have to wait for certain seasons.
That's Corey Bradley, the manager of this hydroponic farm and several others like it throughout the city. He says this farm can produce up to 3 acres of fresh produce for the neighborhood, all while teaching students every step of the farming process.
There's not farms in an urban city, so by having a hydroponic farm in the middle of an urban community, it exposes more people, the youth, to agriculture.
These University City students chartered their FFA chapter in January as the last step to earn state approval for their agriculture program. It's one of the first FFA chapters in St. Louis and its suburbs. But the school is situated in a hub for life sciences. It's within driving distance of huge biotech firms like Bayer and MilliporeSigma, as well as incubators for agriculture startups. University City school officials see diverse career opportunities for their agriculture students. That's true in urban technology centers around the country, according to Christine White with the National FFA Organization.
When you think about agriculture holistically, from pre-research all the way to consumers, the food, ag, and natural resources value chain has opportunities for all students to engage in the industry.
The national organization changed its name from Future Farmers of America to FFA back in 1988 in a bid to reach students in urban centers. Today, nearly a fifth of all FFA chapters are situated in urban and suburban areas. White says cities including Chicago and Philadelphia have strong FFA presence, and more cities are following suit.
It's one of our growing and emerging areas. I think as you start to see suburban areas and urban areas becoming more, not prevalent, but they're seeing themselves as when you look at agriculture from the wider context, especially when you're looking at it from a food, natural resources, and in those areas.
Arlington, Texas has a long history with FFA. The high school's chapter dates back to 1938. Still, FFA advisor Tanner Smith says, like many of his urban students, he didn't come from an agriculture background.
I learned about FFA and the rest is history. I raised goats and cattle and chickens through high school. I went and got a degree in agriculture sciences, and now I'm here teaching these kids.
Smith says his former students have taken careers in diverse fields, including wildlife management, agriculture marketing, and veterinary medicine. In Omaha, Nebraska, Taylor Cooper says not every FFA student plans a career in agriculture. The advisor at Bryan High School points to one of her students who plans to go into cosmetology. She says the junior is making a line of hair products as part of her independent study.
She is growing the plants herself, so then she can actually process them. So really cool, like even finding that connection there with a career that's not in anywhere ag has been one of our like biggest successes for our kids.
Back at University City High School, students are preparing to compete in state and national FFA competitions. Senior Imani Bailey is the new chapter's inaugural president. She's considering a career in biotech after her recent exposure to agriculture.
It still touched my heart just seeing how many people support us and how many people were actually involved in trying to help us. I think about it almost every week.
And that's exactly what's so exciting to farm manager Corey Bradley, who says these hands-on experiences can change students' lives. I'm Katie Gravich, Harvest Public Media.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Beavers are powerful architects of the land and bring many benefits to the environment and to us. But colonialism helped drive beavers off their land. One Blackfeet Nation scientist wants to bring them back with robots. Jamie Jeong has the story.
Engineering postdoc Jordan Kennedy is about to meet her first robot beaver, also called BeaverBot 2.0. We're in a workshop in the Science Center at Harvard University with her robotics team.
Oh my God, I love it.
It's a pale plywood box sitting on wide wheels that has two shovel-like attachments in the front, like a little excavator. It doesn't look like a beaver, but it's supposed to work the land like a beaver would. One of Jordan's team jostles the robot around, bumping like it's on uneven ground. Beavers are incredible engineers. They can make rivers run backwards, create fish habitat, mitigate wildfires, among other things. Jordan's from the Blackfeet Nation, where the beaver is revered. But in the past few centuries, American settlers hunted the beavers en masse and destroyed their habitat, driving them out of the lands they used to build on. the environment and the people living there suffered. Jordan wants to reverse that harm.
I mean, the very best thing you could do is partner with Beavers directly, like full stop.
Beavers leave architectural cues to help the next generation build. Research shows if the conditions are right, Beavers will also take over human imitations of their work. Jordan's trying to bring signs back into the land for Beavers to read with her robots.
Literally partnering with Beavers and then trying to communicate with them in the same way that they would communicate with each other to try to get them to recolonize sites and build up those sites.
She'll be doing that at Rumney Marsh. It's an hour's drive north of Boston. There's tall grass here that I could see Beavers using for foraging if they lived here. The ocean is right there at Revere Beach. Two giant rivers flow inland by the highway, creating miles of wetland. Rumney Marsh hasn't had beavers for over a century, and it's lost all signs of their architecture. This marsh is actually the only thing stopping these rivers from overflowing and flooding the surrounding towns, Saugus, Revere, and Lynn. In the last few decades, big storms have flooded thousands of homes here. As sea levels rise, those disasters could be more common. But you know what stops flooding? Beavers.
We're trying to reimagine these landscapes as if beavers had been deployed on them in order to figure out a way to make it hold more water.
Jordan's robots will dig around Rumney Marsh the way a foraging beaver would. Then hopefully, real beavers will move in.
The most ideal thing for Rumney Marsh would be to get this landscape to a point where beavers are like, this looks good. I got it from here, you know?
While this idea is new to Western science, Blackfeet people have been in partnership with beavers for a long time. Alicia Yellow Owl says the beaver brings great medicine to other animals, including us.
That's how powerful he is that he can create an ecosystem sometimes out of nothing.
Alicia teaches Blackfeet community members to build beaver dam analogs, makeshift structures in the water that imitate beaver dams. She wants conditions to be right for beavers to move in.
When a beaver comes in and makes his lodge, it helps the plants, it helps the water, it helps the animals, it helps the birds. So every living species around him, it touches.
Not everyone sees it from Alicia's perspective. Sometimes beavers flood homes or gnaw at our built environment. That's when Jim Vale, a beaver biologist from the Blackfeet Nation, comes in. His job is to mediate conflicts between beavers and humans. Part of that is sharing ways of living with the beaver, knowledge that was once criminalized.
The elders feel like that is slipping by because there's not enough beaver or not enough people educating the community on the population of the beaver.
Now Alicia and Jim want people to relearn that knowledge and see the world the beaver's way. Jordan says it's a worldview that's urgently needed to protect our lands and ourselves.
We are on a doomed path, for sure.
But Jordan says we can strike a new path if we apply this framework to other animals like prairie dogs and bison.
It's about reestablishing partnerships with animals on the landscape.
And finding a way to live together long into the future. For Our Living Lands, I'm Jamie Jiang.
That was Jamie Jiang, freelance reporter in Boston, Massachusetts. Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street here on Prairie Public, stay with us. Next, it's All Things Considered from NPR. What happens when friendship collides with time, silence, and success? In Strange Girls, author Savette Lacine explores the complicated bond between two writers and the messy, powerful nature of friendship. That story and more next on All Things Considered here on Prairie Public. And tonight at 8 p.m. Central, it's Kelly Corrigan Wonders, show for people who like to laugh while they think, exploring our curious human habits and what they reveal about how we live, connect, and grow. That's tonight at 8 p.m. here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public comes from local businesses who value trusted news, in-depth storytelling, and a well-informed community. If you own or manage a business, consider sponsoring Prairie Public. Your message reaches a loyal and attentive audience and supports the programs your customers rely on. and we can work with any budget to create a sponsorship plan that's right for you. Learn more at prairiepublic.org/sponsor or call 800-359-6900.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Climate change could mean less water for Los Angeles, which currently gets most of its supply from Northern California and the Colorado River. As Franny Halperin from H2O Radio explains, the city has plans to become more resilient by making what's old new again.
Federal officials say the West is in the worst snow drought.
The worst snow drought.
Snow drought.
I've never seen anything like it.
If you live in the U.S. Southwest, the meager snowpack in the Rockies is hard to ignore. And for good reason. It's the source of drinking water for millions and vital for agriculture. The question weighing on many people's minds is whether this could be our new normal.
Is it a sign of things to come? Climate models do suggest that snow droughts are likely to become more common in the future.
That's Peter Goebel, assistant state climatologist with the Colorado Climate Center. He says we're not done having cold, snowy winters. But
you may start to see the probability of events like this creep up through the coming years and decades.
In large part, he says, that's because as we heat up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, precipitation will more likely fall as rain rather than snow, which will either evaporate or be taken up by plants before it can flow into waterways like the Colorado River.
Just based on what we're seeing both in our climate observations and some of our climate models, it makes sense to really prepare to do more with less.
But less could be more. At least that's the plan in Los Angeles. If less water is going to fall from the sky or come through aqueducts, the city will just make their own.
When we're done in the next 2 years, it'll be a new water supply for the city of LA, producing enough water for almost 500,000 people.
That's Jesus Gonzalez with the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. We're at the Tillman Water Reclamation Plant in the San Fernando Valley, just north of downtown LA. The facility treats wastewater from homes and businesses. Some of that clean water is used to irrigate parks, and the rest eventually flows to the ocean. But now, the plan is to store it underground. That's because the Tillman facility sits above a massive aquifer, over 200 square miles in size. Currently, the basin is at about half of its capacity, but it's a glass half full.
The city of LA has this tremendous resource, the San Fernando Groundwater Basin, the aquifer. It can hold almost 2 years of water supply for the entire city of LA.
A new advanced water purification facility at Tillman plans to fill that basin. Gonzalez and I are standing at the future plant's construction site, which is crawling with heavy equipment as cranes lift beams and concrete into place. He says the new water recycling facility will be the size of 3 Costco buildings stacked one on top of the other. When it comes online in 2027, most of the purified water it creates from homes and businesses will be stored in the aquifer for a not rainy day.
And now we have a source of locally controlled, drought-proof water supply that we could pump during the next drought.
That means a more resilient water source that's less vulnerable to earthquakes and less dependent on imported supplies from the Colorado River and Northern California, all without increasing water rates for customers, thanks to state and federal grants helping to offset the nearly $1 billion price tag. Had LA gone with a desalination plant, Gonzalez says it would have been 5 to 10 times more expensive and used way more energy.
It would be negligible in terms of the overall net effect on a customer's bill.
So after Tillman is complete and the next drought strikes, the city will retrieve water from the aquifer, clean it again, and distribute it to taps of LA customers, who eventually will send it down their drains. In the past, that wastewater would have been treated at the Hyperion Water Reclamation Plant near LAX before being discharged to the ocean. Within the next two decades, as a part of the Pure Water Los Angeles initiative, Hyperion will also become a major recycling facility and send its purified water back to the San Fernando Valley to begin the loop again.
So in other words, the cycle and that closed system will continue.
So I was trying to explain the city's recycling plans to my mother before this interview, and she said,
"You mean they're making forever water?"
Very good. That's a great way of describing it. It's a cycle that almost can never end.
By 2040, Los Angeles plans to have 70% of its water supply coming from local sources, with most of that being recycled. So, as the expression goes, what happens in LA stays in LA. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
Most North Dakotans know that the Red River Valley is a portion of the former lake bed of Glacial Lake Agassiz. There are other glacial lake plains in the state that are less well known. I was thinking about that recently while thumbing through the former state geologist John Bloomley's book, North Dakota's Geological Legacy, from 2016. Glacial Lake Agassiz, of course, formed during the end of the last ice age as the glacier retreated. It's known for its flat topography and agricultural productivity, which is largely due to the lake deposits that form deep, rich soils that make for very productive farmland. And unlike many other areas of eastern North Dakota, one does not find many rock piles in these fields. Among the less well-known glacial lake plains is Glacial Lake Souris. Like Glacial Lake Agassiz, this lake also formed at the end of the last ice age. It covered a portion of southwest Manitoba and southeast Saskatchewan, and in North Dakota, a strip of land between Turtle Mountain and the Souris River, southward to near Denby, and eastward to the Rugby area. As such, it covered much of Bottineau and McHenry counties, as well as portions of Rolette and Pierce counties. Like Glacial Lake Agassiz, Glacial Lake Souris is also quite flat, contains deep, rich soils, and is some of the most productive farmland in the state. There are also areas of nearshore and offshore sandy areas and sand dunes associated with the lake, particularly around the Towner, Bantry, and Denby areas. There are a few other glacial lake beds in eastern North Dakota. Glacial Lake Candu in the Candu area occupies parts of Benson, Ramsey, and Towner counties, while Glacial Lake Minnewaukan is an earlier version of the present-day Devil's Lake. And in Dickey and Sargent counties, to the north and south of Highway 11, between Foreman and Oaks and the James River, is Glacial Lake Dakota, which continues southward into South Dakota's James River Basin. So as you travel these or other expansive areas of relatively flat landscapes with rich soils and few, if any, rock piles in the fields, keep in mind that they may be also glacial lake plains. They're often important agriculturally productive areas. There are also ice-walled lake plains or elevated lake plains in eastern North Dakota, but we'll save that topic for later. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. Birds in the subtropics of the Andes Mountains have to be creative to get their share of food from the forest. To outsip their competition, sword-billed hummingbirds have a distinct adaptation. These birds' beaks are longer than their bodies. Found in the temperate forests from Venezuela to Bolivia, these hummingbirds have co-evolved with various flower species to create a niche food source. They rely entirely on tube-like flowers that other species could never reach. While their sword-like beaks are handy for reaching a snack undisturbed by others, a beak that long doesn't come without challenges. For one thing, it's difficult to keep clean. The solution? Sliding it back and forth against tree branches, like a knight sharpening their blade. Then there's the problem of cleaning their feathers. Most birds can easily use their tongues, since they don't have a big, awkward beak to get in the way. Instead, sword-billed hummingbirds put their flexibility to the test and clean themselves with a good old scratch from their legs. So one big adaptation leads to new challenges. But these clever birds are up to the job. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 10th. Alexander Griggs was a trader who used flatboats to transport goods to Canada. In the fall of 1870, he set out too late and became stuck at a French trading post when the river froze. He spent the winter in a cabin he built and began to realize he had found an excellent location for a new settlement. By the time Griggs planted a new town in 1875, steamboats were already operating on the Red River. Grand Forks became an important stop for both goods and passengers. Steamboats were the dominant form of travel in the Red River Valley, and Grand Forks began to grow. But the city faced stiff competition. James J. Hill's Northern Pacific Railroad had reached Fargo and was extending across Dakota Territory. While steamboats were convenient on the river, it was clear that railroads represented the future of transportation. Fortunately for Grand Forks, Hill was a visionary. He looked west, but also looked north. On this date in 1880, his St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Manitoba Railway, later named the Great Northern Railroad, reached Grand Forks. Hill had correctly identified that the railroad would provide vital service to the Red River Valley, the most populated area of what would become North Dakota. The arrival of the railroad was a game-changer for Grand Forks. Steamboats couldn't operate for almost half the year when the river was frozen. The railroad ran year-round, connecting Grand Forks to the rest of the country, opening new trade routes, and attracting businesses. As the city grew, new settlers arrived. The 1880 census recorded about 6,000 residents in Grand Forks County. 10 years later, that population had tripled. The growth spurred more commerce, new houses, schools to accommodate children, and new businesses. Today, railroads don't play the same role they once did. Most travel is by car or air, and goods move on interstate highways. But railroads remain vital to North Dakota, shipping 83% of the state's grain and oilseed. Trains continue to carry North Dakota crops to markets across the country and around the world. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We are at an inflection point when it comes to journalism, a fork in the road, if you will. We could head down the path to where only a few agenda-driven companies control the flow of information. Or we could energize the reliable sources for fact-driven, unbiased, uninfluenced news. One of those dependable sources is public radio. While trusted publications often require a paid subscription, public radio's over-the-air and digitally on-demand service is free for everyone. We rely on voluntary donations from our listeners to share in the costs. In North Dakota, public radio means Prairie Public. So please support the excellent regional coverage and the global and national reporting here at NPR. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the donate tab.
Iranian Kurdish opposition groups exiled in Iraq are preparing for the fall of the Islamic Republic next door in Iran.
Iranian regime will fall. The end could be now or in 1 year, but the Americans will support us and we are going in.
A visit to one of their camps on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org. And better yet, subscribe to Main Street. You can do that wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on Main Street, Watford City. It's been one of North Dakota's fastest growing communities during the Bakken boom. Now the challenge is building a stable future. Mayor Phil Riley joins us to talk about housing, workforce shortages, and a unique local program helping provide and expand daycare availability, along with how the city is planning for long-term economic stability while preserving the quality of life that draws families to Western North Dakota. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.